Airlines Confidential with Ben Baldanza and Scott McCartney is made possible with support from Pratt & Whitney, committed to working smarter, cleaner, and greener today for a more sustainable tomorrow. Learn more at PrattWhitney.com. DoHop, revolutionizing travel connectivity. Learn how to unlock unlimited connections simply at DoHop.com. And Cirium, the world's most trusted source of aviation analytics. Visit Cirium.com. We also welcome your business's support. Info at airlinesconfidential.com.
Welcome to Airlines Confidential. I'm Scott McCartney, and I'm issuing a wonk warning right up front. When you start contemplating the relationship between concentration and competition, you enter the wonk world. And I'll be deep in it with my conversation coming up with William McGee, an airline consumer advocate who has co-authored a paper on how to, quote, fix, quote, the airline industry. I think listeners will find the conversation both animated and interesting, but fair warning, we probably get pretty wonky in airline economics and whether air service is a utility the government should run or not. Ben Baldanza, I know you are sometimes comfortable in the wonk world, so strap in and hang on. I promise it will be a fun ride, one for the history books, really, or maybe just the textbooks.
I'm ready, Scott, and I'm looking forward to hearing it. I'm sorry I had to miss the conversation with Bill because of a schedule conflict. These issues are very timely and very important, and I'm glad that we are diving into them on Airlines Confidential. It's important to the future of our industry. It's important to our economy, and it's important to anyone who flies. I hope airline executives, employees, and customers all appreciate the debate over the issues, or at least they enjoy the back and forth.
And speaking of back and forth, Ben, some news on the back and forth about the next generation of single-aisle commercial airplanes. The Wall Street Journal broke a story that Brazilian aircraft maker Embraer is thinking of building a bigger airplane the size of 737s and A320s. This would be a huge undertaking and a huge development for air travel. Somebody is going to challenge the duopoly that Boeing and Airbus have enjoyed for the past 30 years or so in the 180-seat market. They're having so much trouble and are stuck with aging products. There's huge opportunity here, and the door keeps getting opened wider. That said, you're talking about tens of billions of dollars in development over at least 10 years. You're talking about huge engineering needs and know-how. Embraer specializes in regional jets and business jets. Bigger airplanes are a big, big step up. The Journal reported that an internal assessment at Embraer determined that the company had the technology know-how and the manufacturing might to pull it off. Whether the company has the capital and the stomach to bet everything on an Airbus-Boeing challenge remains to be seen. The Journal also quoted the CEO of one of the largest aircraft leasing firms as saying it was a long shot. I do think, however, that unless Boeing gets to work soon on a new airplane, it will be left behind in the future, the Sears Roebuck of airplanes. For those of you under 30, Google it.
I think there may ultimately be a couple of challengers to the duopoly. Some smart people, including my friend Barry Eccleston, formerly of Airbus, are working on a blended wing concept we talked about before on the show. I think every airline would love to see Embraer look hard at developing a mid-sized competitor. Not sure they'd buy it, but they'd love to see more competition. Speaking of more competition, Frontier Airlines reported a loss of $26 million last week, the result of intense competition. It's interesting. Frontier said revenue in the first quarter was 2% on a capacity increase of 8%. It can take time to build new routes into profitability. The good news for Frontier was that unit costs were down 5%. So even though the net loss was twice as big as last year, there was good news for Frontier for the rest of this year.
One other competition news note, Ben. Spirit announced 5 new routes from Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. None of this is huge stuff. It's like 4 times weekly to Columbus, Ohio, 3 times weekly to Memphis and Milwaukee, 2 times weekly to San Antonio. Spirit used to be bigger at DFW. I wanted to mention this because it's exactly what you have said before, Ben. Spirit needs to get away from serving tiny cities and go where the passengers are. Rebuilding in DFW, where, by the way, Frontier has been aggressively filling in, it's an interesting turn or return. Another return, I know you wanted to respond to some of the things John Brayalt of the National Consumers League said on last week's show. So have at it, Professor Ben, father of airline fees.
Thanks, Scott. Let me first say I hate the term junk fees. At least with airlines, the fees that are charged are for a specific service, transporting your checked luggage, giving you a seat assignment in advance, selling you a bottle of water, or an earlier boarding position, or the services of an airline agent. You get service for your fee, just like you do when you go to the dentist or call an electrician or want your car washed. You always paid those fees, always. But when they are rolled into the price of a ticket, you pay them whether you use them or not. That would be a junk fee. Paying for a service you don't use. By unbundling, airlines charge you for what you use and don't charge you for what you don't use. And so more people can save more money. It seems to me that should be what consumer advocates want. Paying for something they don't use would be a ripoff. In terms of the refund rule, I think the government may well be creating a bigger problem. More rules and exceptions lead to more confusion, not less. By forcing airlines to automatically refund tickets, you may end up restricting passenger ability to get rebooked on another flight. That's usually what people want. They still need to get where they are going. I think some standardization of refund rules for the industry could be helpful to travelers. But forcing airlines to automatically refund may work against travelers. In addition, I think there should be more accountability for the role government itself plays in air transportation. Airlines get blamed when government services like air traffic control fail. If we really want to improve air travel, let's focus on fixing the foundation of the house first before we repaint the bedroom. The foundation of the house is the failing air traffic control system, which is run by the same Department of Transportation that wants to hold airlines more accountable. I'd love to hear more from DOT about how it is going to get its own house in order so that consumers will benefit. The new rule focuses on baggage and change fees. Let's talk about baggage first. Most airlines charge different prices for a bag based on when you buy relative to departure. It's usually cheapest if you buy the bag when you buy the ticket, more expensive if you buy when you check in for the flight, and a little more expensive if you buy at the airport on flight day. I guess that airlines could bundle the lowest price since that is what applies when the booking is made. But if a customer chooses to not buy the bag then and then faces a higher fee at the airport, they may feel that they got ripped off. It might encourage airlines to develop a new idea. Reserve your bag now, but don't pay until check-in. This would mean no fee added at the shopping since they are not making a commitment to buy yet. You don't get charged for a meal if you don't show up at a dinner reservation. Added to this, many customers get a free first checked bag due to their credit card or loyalty program. Now, even when shopping, you'll have to enter all this information in. Otherwise, you will get wrong prices because the airline will bundle a bag fee in even though you don't pay. This is making it more cumbersome for consumers. Like all regulations, a well-intended idea is fraught with problems at implementation. Now, for change fees, the change fee doesn't apply until you change something. At the time of booking, all you could bundle is $0 because no change fees apply. I don't understand this part of the rule at all. The government is clearly frustrated, but they are just pounding the table.
Yeah, I think those are all great points, Ben. And you're right on the change fee. Where, to the extent the change fees still exist at all, You don't want to make the change, and you certainly don't want to pay the fee in advance. And that's all the perfect foundation for my upcoming conversation with Bill McGee. But first, let's thank our sponsors who make it possible for us to offer this product without any junk fees. We want to thank Cirium. Cirium offers the most accurate and precise data and analytics to enable airlines to optimize planning, operations, and passenger services. The right intelligence drives operational efficiencies and enables you to predict market shifts and helps airlines respond quickly to maximize revenue, manage costs, and seize commercial opportunities. Visit Cirium.com for more.
We also want to thank Pratt & Whitney. At Pratt & Whitney, the pursuit of more sustainable aviation is foundational. For decades, Pratt & Whitney has been at the forefront of revolutionary advancements in aircraft propulsion technology, and by working smarter, cleaner, and greener today, they are committed to supporting the aviation industry in its goal of reaching net zero CO2 emissions by 2050. Learn more about Pratt & Whitney's smarter technology, cleaner fuel, and greener business at PrattWhitney.com.
And we want to thank DoHop, which is revolutionizing travel connectivity. DoHop is a travel technology provider enabling airlines to expand their networks, offer more connectivity, create additional partnerships, and focus on improving the customer experience with more offers, services, and travel options. Airlines benefit from generating additional revenue, lower costs, and maintaining full customer ownership. Plus, in the event of travel disruptions, DoHop works with airlines and offers assistance in helping passengers reach their final destination. Visit DoHop.com. That's DoHop.com.
Okay, Scott Wonkaway, I'm eager to hear Bill McGee explain why we need to regulate the airline industry.
William J. McGee is a senior fellow for aviation and travel at the American Economic Liberties Project. During his 22 years at Consumer Reports, he testified before Congress numerous times on airline mergers, competition, safety, and passenger rights. He's an FAA-licensed aircraft dispatcher and was a flight release officer in the U.S. Air Force Auxiliary. He is the author of Attention All Passengers, a 2012 book published by HarperCollins, and he lectures at Vaughan College of Aeronautics. Recently published a provocative piece with Ganesh Sitraman of Vanderbilt University titled How to Fix Flying, A New Approach to Re-regulating the Airline Industry. There's a lot of attention in Washington focused on fixing flying from the DOT rules and the FAA reauthorization that we talked about last week to the Federal Trade Commission's aggressive antitrust stance against mergers, which broke up JetBlue and Spirit. So it's a good time to talk to Bill about ideas to create new regulations that would change competition in the airline world. Welcome to Airlines Confidential, Bill.
Well, thanks very much, Scott. I appreciate it. It's always good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you. I want to start broad before we get into some of the specific proposals you make. You say in the piece that the promise of deregulation was lower fares, more entry, and greater options. It strikes me that that's exactly what we got. What's wrong with airline deregulation today that would require re-regulation?
Well, it's a fair question. First of all, we're not using the term re-regulation, just to be clear. We're calling it regulation because re-regulation implies that we want to go back to the system that was in place from 1938 to 1978. And Ganesh and I are suggesting some new forms. But having said that, yes, we are using the R word. Okay? Yeah. It's a conversation that I think you'll agree with me. We would not have been having 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, certainly not 20 years ago. The R word is coming up more and more frequently. We are embracing it and we're taking it on head on. So that's the context there. And just, you know, one quick aside. In 2010, I served on Secretary Raymond LaHood's DOT Future of Aviation Advisory Committee. There were 19 members. I was the only consumer advocate. That tells you the fights I had. On opening day, this is, of course, under the Obama administration, Secretary LaHood said, you guys are going to be here for 9 or 10 months. You're free to discuss anything you want and make any recommendations you want, except for two issues. One is security, because that's no longer DOT FAA. That is now TSA. And the other is deregulation, because it is the position of the Obama administration that airline deregulation will not be changed. So we literally could not even discuss the topic, and that was 14 years ago. Times have changed. I think whenever we talk about deregulation, it's interesting to me because it's a bit of a Rorschach test. You know, people have different ideas of what it was supposed to do, what it was meant to do, how it's played out. And so for me, you know, just like when we talk about the Constitution or a religious tract or anything else, let's go back to the source material. So I read the entire Airline Deregulation Act of 1978 last year. It's over 1,000 pages. And I will just, you know, show you exactly what it says. This is what we were promised. This isn't even in the text yet. This is in the summary at the beginning before we get to the first period. It says five things. The maintenance of safety is highest priority. I think we all agree with that. Number two, placing maximum reliance on competition. Number three, encouragement of air service at major urban areas through secondary airports. Number four, the avoidance of unreasonable industry concentration. Number five, the encouragement of entry into air transportation markets. Well, Scott, by that measure, regardless of whether someone is pro-deregulation or opposed to deregulation, by that measure, I would argue that it has failed because those promises have not been fulfilled. We are now in a place we've never been in the history of U.S. aviation. This is the most concentrated industry ever, from the pre-regulated period, the regulated period, or the deregulated period. You have to go back to the very beginning, the first flight in 1914. We now have 12 scheduled passenger carriers in the U.S. We just went through a 14-year period from 2007 to 2021 without a single new entrant scheduled carrier until Avelo and Breeze started up. And we now have a level of concentration at the top, an oligopoly, with the big four controlling 80%. And before anybody screams, no, it's not 80%. Yeah, it is when you include American Eagle and Delta, Connection and United Express. And so we are in this level of concentration we never had. Those promises that we were made about more competition, maximum reliance on it, avoidance of unreasonable industry concentration, encouragement of entry, that has not been fulfilled right on the face of it. So I think the conversation really has to begin there. What we were promised versus what has happened.
So that leads exactly into my next question about consolidation. But can't you have consolidation and still have competition? I'm not sure that the two are mutually exclusive. With the big four airlines, you could argue that you have more competition worldwide because they have much farther reach than eight smaller airlines would have. How do you see the big four airlines operating against consumer interests?
Well, I see it four times a year very clearly, and I think anyone else can too because it's a public document. Four times a year, the Department of Transportation puts out its quarterly airfare report, right? This is not the monthly air travel consumer report, but the quarterly airfare report. And I'm such an aviation geek that I, spend a weekend reading it every 3 months. And when you look at that, you see that we really have two industries in the United States. We have the big four, really the big three, and Southwest. We could have another discussion about that. Southwest is sometimes competitive, sometimes not. Sometimes they're in lockstep with the big three. Sometimes they are genuine, the Southwest that we all remember from the 80s and 90s, a genuine disruptor in terms of price, et cetera. But the bottom line is, somewhere about the early 2000s is where I pinpoint it. The big carriers, the major hub and spoke network, legacy airlines, American, Delta, United, and all of the carriers that made them up through consolidation, they stopped competing with each other effectively on price. And this is not Phil McGee's opinion. It's not Ganesh Sitamaran's opinion. This is, as I said, every quarter you see it. So what do we see? We see there's two really great parts to the DOT report. And one of them is they show the markets in the previous quarter that had the highest fare increases and the highest fare decreases. And what you see is that the decreases always, not sometimes, not a lot of the time, always come when a ultra low cost carrier enters the market or a low cost carrier, right? So whether it's Spirit, Allegiant, Frontier, now Breeze and Avelo, sometimes JetBlue, sometimes Southwest, that's where fares go down. If American, Delta, and United are the only choice, as they are for hundreds of cities around the country, if they're the only choice, any combination of the one, two, or three of them, then that's where the fares are the highest. So I don't, we don't use the term oligopoly lightly. This is an oligopoly. The big four have a lockstep. We see it in how they respond to questions through Airlines for America. They, the Senate asks them to give them information and they respond as one. They speak as one.
Yeah, but fares are the big success here, not the big problem. I mean, if you look at look at average domestic fares. It's so much cheaper today to fly than it was in the regulated days. And we've seen, you know, airfare is consistently, you know, $360 to $380. You adjust for inflation, and it's much cheaper. There's so many other consumer areas that have gotten so much more expensive, and airfare has remained relatively constant, which means that it's gotten cheaper on an inflation-adjusted basis. Where is airfare outrageously expensive?
In much of the country. And I'm glad you raised it, because I think this is, you know, this is a crux of a lot of this. I mean, what you just said is a very common, you know, point that we hear all the time, that, you know, when adjusting
for inflation. That's what the numbers show. I mean, let me
just make 3 points on that. Number one, the numbers are comparing apples and oranges, because as we well know, the fees are not included. So you are unbundling a fare. If you say that 30 years ago in 1994, a fare was X and now it's Y, we're not looking at apples to apples in two ways. One is we don't include the fees. So without that, we don't have the full picture. And number two, the product itself has been, there's been degradation of the product. So the fact is that in 1994, what you got for $350 on a round trip fare was a much different product than what you have now, without the tighter seat pitch, without the meals, without the checked baggage, without all of those other things. And then the other factor, in addition to that, is what, you know, what we and others are terming regional inequality. The fact is that, you know, look, I live in the greater New York area, so I often fly out of the big New York airports, and I'm lucky because I have options. I have low fare options, ultra low cost carriers. If I want to go to Florida, I can often do it for, you know, a couple hundred bucks or less, depending on if there are sales. But I just went to, in February, I traveled to Missoula, Montana, right? There, you know, much of the country does not have ultra low cost carriers or even low cost carriers. We put it in map form. Much of the country does not have hubs. And again, when you are only served, as much of the country is, by one of the big three or any combination of the big three, you are not getting this, you're not enjoying the benefits of low-cost carriers the way others are. And the fact is, the bandwidth, you know, when you talk about comparing airline pricing to other products, I worked at Consumer Reports for 22 years, so I had these struggles constantly. An editor would say to me something like, you know, what's a good fare? You know, of course, you know, you laugh, right? Are you kidding me? What's a good airfare? There's no such thing. There's no, you know, it varies for so many factors, for so many reasons. You know, they're used to saying, well, here's a good price for a refrigerator or a car or a stereo, right? Well, with the bandwidth of the lowest fares, as again, the DOT fare reports show, to the highest fares can be easily be a factor of three or four. That's what we're talking about here. Now, we are not talking about the largest percentages of the population. But we're looking at the airlines holistically here as a network, as a transportation system, and much of America has been left behind.
All right. Well, we'll get more into small cities and other issues. I want to mention a few things that I thought were important points that we have a lot of agreement on. You call on Congress to support innovation. I think that's a lot of us have been saying that's sorely lacking for a long, long time. You call for requiring interlining between airlines so that when one cancels, a ticket can be used on a different airline and airlines can settle up between themselves. That'll make travel more reliable for people. You call for funding real air traffic control improvements. Yay to that. You call for empowering state attorneys general to be able to sue airlines for unfair and deceptive practices, just like any other company operating in their states. All those things I argued for loudly when I was writing The Middle Seat.
Right.
But in terms of, since we've been talking about pricing, in terms of some of the more controversial ideas, you talk about opaque and deceptive pricing systems. And I understand the frustration with add-on fees, especially when airlines are yield managing fees and changing them flight to flight. But in general, In general, the internet has given us perfect pricing information in air travel. You can compare prices for air travel much, much easier than you can compare car prices or stereo prices or grocery prices or plumbers or lawyers or banks or phones, you name it. With air travel, you used to have to call an agent or the airline. And when you said, how much is it to go to Cleveland? You got the answer you got was a question. Well, when do you want to go? Well, I want to go at 8 a.m. Well, the price for 8 a.m. is, well, is there a cheaper price? Well, maybe 10 a.m. And, you know, it was difficult to compare prices. Now, it may not be perfect, but it's a whole lot more comparable than other industries. So why should government regulate price comparison when it doesn't force that in other industries?
Well, let's start with the prices themselves before we even talk about fees. Right now, as we speak, this could change in the coming days, but right now, as we speak, we're waiting for the finalization of FAA reauthorization, which, of course, has been going on for a long time, for over a year now. And we've been heavily involved in trying to see some good stuff get in there and some bad stuff get out. One of the things that worked its way back in is rescinding a DOT rule that has worked very effectively for over a decade. That's the full fare advertising rule, right? And that's the one, to be clear, this is about not about ancillary fees or junk fees or things that, you know, that you theoretically have a choice on, like baggage. This is the stuff that you and I have no choice on, right? That we have to pay federal taxes, you know, airport taxes, 9/11 security fees for TSA, et cetera, right? Now, that rule has been very effective and has worked very well because basically it says this is the bottom line price that you, you know, regardless of what you add to it, that's what you're going to get. And the airline lobby has been working around the clock. Even though we had a victory on this over a decade ago, as I said, they continue to lobby to get this back in. And they convinced the House Transportation Infrastructure Committee to put it back into this year's FAA reauthorization to rescind that. Of course, it's very Orwellian language. They say this provides more clarity. Well, of course, it provides less clarity. Those are the type of fights, you know, with the airline lobby, you can never declare victory and move on because they come back again next year and you're fighting the same fight. One of the things that drives me is a statistic that I know you remember Kevin Mitchell, our colleague who passed away recently. He's a good friend of mine. And Kevin did great work in this area. And a couple of years ago, he called me very excited and he said, Bill, we got it. And I said, what's that? He goes, we got this number. American Airlines had publicly disclosed that 80, this was about 5 years ago, to be clear, it was before COVID, about American Airlines said something like 87% of their passengers fly less than once a year. Somewhere in the neighborhood of, Gallup polls back this up, but somewhere in the neighborhood of like every, you know, 15 to 18 months, right? So that's what drives a lot of what I do when I'm wearing a consumer advocate hat. Because, you know, the complexity of this system overwhelms people. They don't understand how to go about this. Yes, there are tools at your fingertips. There's no question. You're right about, you know, online travel agencies, et cetera. But what do you do with those tools now that you have them? And are you, you know, do you book today? Do you book next week? Do you book right away and lock it in? Do you wait and do a, you know, a watch for 2 weeks? It involves a tremendous amount of time and work and energy and frustration. You know, there are those that are experts at this because, you know, business travelers and road warriors. But for the bulk of the American population, booking air travel is something that, you know, makes them very skittish.
Well, and that's only if they want the absolute lowest, cheapest price, right? You can go book today if you don't care about the price, and it's real easy. The problem, I think, with thinking about this is if you want to take away the complexity and go to some kind of, you know, fixed average fare situation, you've just eliminated the lowest prices, right? Because in many ways, the high fare passengers are subsidizing the low fare passengers. And if you take away that ability for the airline to fill the airplane with a wide variety of passenger fares based on supply and demand, then you're going to raise the lowest prices and people aren't going to have those options.
Well, Ganesh and I worked on this paper for about a year. So we had countless, you know, Zooms and calls and emails back and forth. And trust me, we looked at all of these things. And we don't want to see the, you know, the elimination of the ultra low cost segment. You know, we look, I was very vocal in opposing the JetBlue Spirit merger. American Economic Liberties Project probably was as loud as anybody out there. I spent a week in Boston at that trial. And one of the key reasons was we did not want to see Spirit go away. And that's exactly what would have happened with JetBlue. We all know that JetBlue had a higher cost structure and a higher fare structure than Spirit. And this isn't something that often gets talked about or even thought about by a lot of folks. But the bottom line is it's Spirit or nothing for a large segment of lower income Americans, you know, visiting family, visiting grandparents, whatever. You know, if you can't get Spirit or Allegiant or Frontier, then you may not be going at all, right? So that's why we fought so hard and loud to keep the Spirits. And the nation and I are not saying that they should go away here. But what we are talking about is more simplicity in pricing. And if the products are clearly differentiated, and so clearly, you know, Spirit has a different product than United does. We all know that. Then they are priced in different buckets, but you're also getting different products. Ganesh is a professor at Vanderbilt University, and his area of specialty is not aviation, it's utilities. He speaks on utilities in different industries. And so we are arguing that the airlines and that transportation systems in general are utilities and should be priced accordingly and should be afforded accordingly, because some people have benefited under the regulated era and deregulated era, excuse me, and some have not.
Right. But if you price on cost, then you just took away Spirit's lowest fares, because Spirit has lost money for the last 4 years. So has JetBlue. JetBlue is going to lose money again this year. When an airline loses money, somebody else is subsidizing the cost of providing that transportation, shareholders, lenders, you know, you name it. But those airlines are posting losses. If you want to regulate it and say, hey, you can charge a fare that'll cover your costs. And, you know, in the regulated days, it was cost plus a little profit, right?
Right.
And so cost plus a little profit is going to raise fares. Period.
It's going to raise fares in some places, and it's going to lower fares in other places, and that's what we're saying. Yeah. You know, we're looking at you know, look at the post office, right? They don't charge you. I'm not talking about UPS or FedEx in the private market, but in the post office, they don't charge you a different cost for a first class stamp from Chicago to Anchorage. It's the same as Chicago to Milwaukee. It's aggregated for the network.
The post office is getting subsidized by the government. Amtrak's getting subsidized by the government. I don't think that's what we want with our.
Well, I don't think. I would argue strongly that the current system has failed. And you know, when you talk about all these mergers, when you talk about the fact that airlines are not profitable, we want to see airlines be profitable. Let me be crystal clear on that. There's a sense here that, you know, oh, well, these guys are, you know, socialists, and they, you know, I mean, we've heard all the criticism, and, you know, they don't understand about profits. I worked in the airlines for 7 years. I come from an airline family. I still have friends in the airlines that I worked with. I'm an airline geek. I don't hate the airlines. I used to love the airlines. But what we're saying is it's a broken system, and most Americans know that.
Okay. So a couple important things I really want to get to. The piece, you suggest re-regulating would include assigning routes and slots. You mentioned Missoula, Montana before, right? Wouldn't that make the industry less efficient? And if it's less efficient, as a result, make air travel more expensive?
Well, you know, back when you go back and you look at the transcripts of the hearings in Congress in the 70s, this was a concern right from the beginning, right? Because particularly for members of Congress in both the House and Senate that represented rural and smaller states, right, and smaller markets, they were afraid of being left out, right? And so that's where the Essential Air System came in, right? The Essential Air Service System, right? That was part of the deregulation in 1978. And that has not worked as it was intended to do. As we know, the major airlines hate it. They don't want to be a part of it. I remember seeing press releases when COVID hit that one of the first things some of the big airlines were saying was, well, we're pulling out of, you know, some of these EAS cities. You know, I understand that, you know, load factors were 10%. We all get it. We know the context of all this. But either we have an air travel system in this country that serves everyone or we don't, right? You talk about Amtrak, you talk about the post office, you talk about government subsidies, certain things, you know, this is what FDR did with electrification in the 1930s. We either are all a part of this, or there are haves and have-nots. We are saying that a haves and have-not system doesn't work. And by the way, when we talk about, you know, regional inequality, you know, clearly you often think of the Missoulas, right? I do. And overwhelmingly red states politically, by the way, just as an aside. But, you know, the states that don't have Delta low-cost carriers, they're often rural, they're often smaller markets. You know, you can draw a line from west of Minnesota and east of Washington State and all of those states, Montana, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, they don't pay the same low fares that those of us that live in other places do. But at the same time, what we're saying is this should be looked at in the broader picture. And in terms of, you know, the promise of deregulation was that they knew back in the 70s that air travel was, you know, was exploding and that the United States wanted to be a part of it. Well, some of us aren't, some of us aren't.
Right. But the point of this is, it's always seemed to me that airlines aren't shy about putting flights in where there are passengers. It's flights where there aren't passengers that are the problem. And if the load factor is 10%, if there aren't people in Missoula to fill an airplane, that's not the airline's fault. And if you want to have air service, you know, with cheap fares and frequency in Missoula, then somebody's got to pay for it. And I don't see why you should pay for it living in New York. With higher fares to subsidize money-losing service in Missoula.
Well, just one quick point, Scott. I just want to clear up. That 10% load factor I was talking about was the early days of COVID, right? That's what I meant. I wasn't talking about as a regular thing, right? Scott, don't I pay for that every time I buy a stamp at the post office? If I mail a letter from, you know, from New York to Philadelphia, it's obviously not going to cost the same for the post office to deliver it as it will if I mail a letter to Honolulu, right? But, you know, the costs are aggregated so that we're all part of the same network. And
yeah, so then you've got one airline, you nationalize it.
Well,
that's the post office.
First of all, we're not talking about nationalizing it. We're still making room for competition as there was in the regulated era, and you can and you know, there were more carriers in the regulated era than there are now. So I'm not being at all facetious about this. I don't get when people argue about competition and deregulation without recognizing that we are now at the most concentrated point that the industry has ever been in since before World War I. That's where we are. We have fewer airlines, less competition. And so how can we now, you know, on the one hand, recognize that, and on the other hand, say, well, deregulation has been a rousing success? That's the part that really, honestly, stymies me.
Well, I mean, I would say you still have a lot of really significant competition. You got four airlines, but there, you know, and four big airlines and those. I mean, the market concentration example you have in the report is Chicago O'Hare to Dallas. There are, and I didn't get that because there are three of the big four serving that route, and both Spirit and Frontier serve it. So there's tremendous competition in that. I mean, airlines go where there are people. That I think that's sort of the bottom line to it. But you could have three airlines. We have three car manufacturers. We have, you know, three cell phone carriers. You can still have competition. Big airlines.
Right, but I would say the key word there is you could. I'm asking a simple question. Do American and Delta and United compete on price? Do they fight as they used to?
They do if they have empty seats. They want to fill their
seats. They have empty seats. Right. So, I mean, when I left the airline industry in 1992 after 7 years of working in the airlines, and I became a reporter and worked at, trade magazines and covering the industry, a beat reporter, I recall, I mean, those days we used faxes, not emails, but I recall the fax machine, you know, going off every Friday afternoon with saying, you know, Continental is launching a new fare sale, you know, and we remember those days. They would bash each other's brains out, Northwest, U.S. Airways, all of them, American, United, Delta. When do we see that? We see it now. Of course, the yield management systems are more sophisticated now, but, you know, you go in and you see, I just did it last week, and I did it 2 weeks ago when I went to Washington. I've flown a couple of times in the last 2 weeks. You see that American and United and Delta, they're lockstep. They're to the penny. you know, it's not like, it doesn't say 250, it says 247.50. And they're all in lockstep. So
Right. That's the perfect pricing information. They know what the other guy is charging and they match. And that's what you want. That is competition.
Well, that's the part that we're arguing they're not competing with each other, that they're in lockstep. I mean, this oligopoly of let's leave Southwest out of it because they're a more complicated situation. The big three, they do not compete as they once did.
Well, I think that's questionable. But let's go on. Another proposal, and this I guess gets to it too, is a 30% cap on the percentage of flights at any one airport to effectively end the hub and spoke system. What's the thinking behind that? Because isn't the hub and spoke system the most efficient way to get the most people where they want to go?
Well, it certainly works for FedEx and UPS, right? But we're not boxes.
Works for my mother who lives in South Carolina, and she can go through Charlotte, she can go through Atlanta, she can get on Southwest in Greenville and go somewhere. I mean, you can live in South Carolina and get most anywhere in the world with one stop. That seems to me hugely efficient.
Okay, so you know we talked about Missoula before. Let me just compare two recent trips I took to smaller airports. In February, I went to Missoula. I needed to be there on a Saturday and Sunday, and it meant a four-day weekend, right? I spent all day Friday flying. This is from New York, one of the largest markets in the country, obviously. I spent all day Friday getting to Missoula, and I spent all day Monday getting home from Missoula. Now, last week, I went to Little Rock, again from New York. And in this case, I was very happy to see that there are two nonstops a day, one from Delta and one from American, to and from Little Rock. Right. So mm-hmm. I was able, not all day, right? It's not, you know, four times a day, once a day, 5 p.m., both, you know, almost like 15 minutes apart from each other, right? Delta and American. Now that made getting to and from Little Rock a heck of a lot easier. Now the airlines are not, you know, clearly they wouldn't operate those flights if they didn't have, if they didn't have the market. And both flights were practically full, right? Middle seats were taken. What we're saying with the cap on the hubs, I just read an article that I urge everyone to take a look at. It was fantastic. In Simple Flying in the March issue, they pointed out the dominance of the fortress hubs. There are 8 fortress hubs in the United States where the dominant carrier, one carrier, controls 70% or more of the market. In Charlotte, it's 88% for American. In Dallas-Fort Worth, it's 84% for American. Houston, 78 for United, Atlanta, 76 for Delta. That's what we're talking about. And one of the keys for us, we spend a lot of time, as you know, and I really appreciate the deep dive you did into the paper because these questions are excellent. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to have a conversation. I should have said this at the top. What Ganesh and I said from the very beginning is we're not pretending we have all the answers, but we're trying to get a conversation going because that's what we had in the 70s. It's been almost 50 years since there's been a national conversation about how do we fix the airlines? And so anyway, my point with the fortress hubs is 88%, 84%, 78%. We're saying, you know, there is no competition when you have that level of domination. And we are not saying to end the hub and spoke system, but what we are saying is that we're looking for, as there was in larger measure in the regulated era than there's been since then, a way for your mother maybe to get from South Carolina to a few destinations without having to spend all day connecting and without having to lock, you know, to lose an entire day of work or school or whatever for a traveler to get to a place, as I did with, you know, Missoula. It was 2 days there and 2 days to get there and back.
So two things. First of all, you know how hubs work. If you cap at 30%, you eliminate exponentially connecting opportunities, right? You have, you know, 50 flights come in and 50 flights go out, and there's two people on each of the flights that fills the next flight. You eliminate a lot of those flights. You just can't serve nearly as many cities. So the service options out of the hub would decrease dramatically with some kind of 30% cap. I don't really understand how you'd enforce a 30% cap either. Airports are local institutions, And I think one of the problems with this is most every hub city wants to be a hub city. You know, Dallas likes it. Charlotte loves it. Charlotte's in fear of losing their hub status, which is ridiculous because it's the most profitable hub for American system. But, well, you know, does Atlanta want to give up being the largest airport in the world? Hell no.
Of course they love it. Now, there's a flip side, right? And this is directly tied to deregulation and consolidation. And that is, you know, you mentioned Atlanta, you mentioned Charlotte, you mentioned Dallas. Of course they love it there. Who wouldn't? You can, you know, you can...
You get on the airplane and go anywhere in the world, almost.
Right. But we all don't live in Atlanta, Dallas, and Charlotte, right? The point is, what about the flip side? What about Memphis and Raleigh-Durham and Pittsburgh and Cincinnati and Cleveland and St. Louis? Cities in the United States that once had vibrant hubs, but due to consolidation, due to deregulation, have closed those hubs. Look, Scott, let's be crystal clear here what I'm saying. You know, I had somebody say to me recently, I had a journalist say to me, do you think airline executives are dumb? And Ganesh and I both said, no, hardly. But they are making decisions for their shareholders for what makes sense for them. And that is not what makes sense in a transportation system for all of us at large. And so when you talk about cities the size of Cleveland and Cincinnati and Pittsburgh that once had hundreds and hundreds of nonstops every day and now have a handful, you know, Ohio had four hubs in four different cities from four different carriers: Cincinnati, Cleveland, Columbus, and Dayton. Delta, Continental, America West, US Airways. How many hubs does Ohio have now? Zero.
Right, but Bill, under that system, nobody was making money. There were multiple bankruptcies and
we're
failures
on the same page because we're saying it's a broken system. You're right. I mean, one of the things that I went back and looked at is how many bankruptcies were there in the regulated period? Virtually none. It was pretty hard to lose money. How many mergers were there? A handful compared to what we've seen now. The number since 1978 is somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 airline mergers in the United States. So that translates to basically one a year. Prior to that, for 40 years, there was a handful. You can count them. I think it was five. That's what we're talking about here, is that I think in a lot of ways, Scott, we're saying the same thing. We obviously don't agree on solutions, but we're saying the same thing. We're saying this is a broken system. The bankruptcies, the challenges with profitability, this is a utility that is operated as a free market enterprise. Now, in the end, we're all on the hook anyway through the bailouts, we the taxpayers. We're saying if we're going to be on the hook anyway, as we were after 9/11, as we were after COVID with, $54 billion bailout and subsidies, if we're going to be on the hook anyway, then let's have a say in how this operates. And to say, well, sorry, St. Louis, you're out of luck. Sorry, Pittsburgh. Sorry, Cincinnati. Sorry, Cleveland. You guys, you know, you're shit out of luck. But, you know, hey. You know, you Charlotte and Dallas, you know, you guys, good for you. That's
You're not shit out of luck. You got flights to, you know, you may have to make a connection.
No, I have to push back on that, Scott, because talk to the mayors and the governors in those places. They lose corporations. Now, if you have if Raleigh-Durham, you know, has a corporation base there and they have a sales force, are they going to pay to have their sales force spend, you know, four flights a day instead of two? We've seen
Raleigh-Durham's,
this. Research
Raleigh-Durham's, this. Raleigh-Durham's a great example because they have nonstop flights to Europe that they didn't have before. They have tremendous growth, particularly with low-cost airlines, particularly this year. Raleigh-Durham has a growing, vibrant business community with relocations. And Raleigh-Durham is a very competitive air market, partly because of that growing business community where airlines are trying to replace the business travelers that they lost. So the Raleigh-Durhams, the Austins, Seattle, Boston, other cities are much more competitive as airlines go hunting for business travelers. They're finding them in Raleigh-Durham. It's a good market. And I don't think Raleigh-Durham, you know, would really want to go back to the American hub where they didn't have that competition. But now, you know, they got a nonstop to Paris, to London, to Frankfurt. They're doing okay.
Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, Cleveland, St. Louis. I mean, those places, you know, Pittsburgh's building. You don't even have to fly in order to be.
I know, but Pittsburgh's Pittsburgh's building a $1 billion terminal. They have pretty good air service in Pittsburgh. I think a lot of places, 20 years ago.
I mean, yeah, they went through some really dark times. We are saying that the system, it should be national, and that you shouldn't, because a CEO makes a decision that makes sense for that CEO. We're not saying they're nonsensical decisions. We all know why American acquired TWA's hub in St. Louis and shut it down, right? All you have to do is look at a map. Everybody knew there was no way they were going to have hubs in Chicago, St. Louis, and Dallas. From a business perspective, it makes all the sense in the world. But what did that do to St. Louis? It had a dramatic effect on St. Louis.
But TWA failed as TWA, right? American bought the assets in bankruptcy because the airline had failed.
Right.
So it's hard to say American should operate a hub that failed. It can't make
it. Well, what are we speaking about here is the volatility of this industry since 1978. The mergers, the bankruptcies, profit and loss looks like the Rocky Mountains, up, down, up, down, up, down, and the bailouts in the end. Because in the end, we are not going to, as a nation, we are not going to let this industry fail. So we are saying we agree with the CEOs when they go hat in hand, to Congress and ask for money when it's bailout time. When they say things like, well, you know, the airline industry is essential to the American economy, American security, our way of life, everything. We agree 100%. But we're saying, you're talking like it's a utility. Let's look at finding ways of regulating like a utility.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there. Bill, this has been fascinating. I hope our listeners have enjoyed it. I think you and I have enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Fascinating issues. And we will talk more, I'm sure, because we haven't solved a darn thing.
Well, we have issues we haven't even gotten into in the paper, right? If I could just do one quick plug, Ganesh and I made a very good team, I think. I've never really worked on a project this big with another person. And his area of expertise is economics and things like that. And of course, I have a long background in safety issues, having worked in the industry and with passenger rights and protections. So I thought it was a very good blend, I'd love to come back and talk more about some of the other things, the safety issues, the frequent flyer programs, et cetera. Scott, you and I have known each other a long time. We're clearly in disagreement on a lot of these issues, but I do sincerely thank you for having me on because I meant it when we said we want to get a conversation going. If somebody has a better idea, then let's talk about it. But why is it that an industry this big that we all know has these fundamental problems, why aren't we talking about it? Why aren't we trying to come up with solutions? And so, and by the way, I would just point out, we're looking for allies, whether it's, labor unions, travel agents, but we found one recently on some issues, not all, through an interesting group, and that's NACA, the National Air Carrier Association. The low-cost carriers and the ultra-low-cost carriers in the United States, they agree with us on a lot of this, particularly on access to airports and issues like that. So other things, they don't agree with us. Let's be clear.
Yeah.
But, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to work with the unions on some of the safety issues, maintenance, et cetera. And so we're trying to get a conversation going. Where this leads, it's anybody's guess. But, we've shot off our, our starter pistol, and here we are.
Excellent. Okay. Bill, thank you so much. It's been great. And we will be right back with more on Airlines Confidential.
Promotional consideration provided by thearchive.net, celebrating 20 years with a fresh new look and over 60,000 items of AvGeek goodness. It's the hub of air transport history, and you're welcome aboard thearchive.net.
Thanks again to Bill and to you, Scott. That was a terrific discussion and definitely a wonky debate. He's much more of a regulator than me, but I appreciate his arguments even when I don't agree.
Thanks, Ben. I want to remind listeners that Airlines Confidential will be on stage for a keynote podcast at Aviation Festival Americas on May 15th in Miami Beach, just a week away. We'll actually be doing two interview sessions the morning of May 15 to open the meeting. This is the 16th year for Aviation Festival Americas, and it brings together more than 250 influential leaders from the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. If you'd like to attend, listeners can get a 50% discount by going to airlinesconfidential.com, clicking on the Aviation Festival banner ad and using the promo code AC50. It's going to be a great event, and we are looking forward to being part of it. We'll have an Airlines Confidential booth, and I'd love to meet you there.
We'll dig into the mailbag next week. I'm sure there will be lots of response to your interview with Bill McGee, Scott. Please send us your thoughts by going to airlinesconfidential.com and clicking on Contact Us. There's a form there to send us messages. We get them directly, and we look forward to responding. Have a great week, everyone.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week in Miami Beach.
This podcast is produced by Mass Media. Info at massmedia.net.